Mini episode 866 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge mini episode number 866. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris today with a guest that we're having back on the show. We very much enjoyed having him on previously. He had a great book when he was on the last time, and a great book this time. Previously, it was When the Braves Ruled the Diamond, 14 Flags Over Atlanta. And the book this time around, it is very, very comprehensive. It takes that same kind of approach, very thorough approach, and applies it to all of Major League Baseball this time. And it is The New Baseball Bible, Notes, Nuggets, Lists, and Legends from Our National Pastime. And again, a pleasure to have back on the show Dan Schlossberg. Dan, thank you so much for coming back on the FDH Lounge. Really looking forward to breaking down this book with you.
Thanks, Rick. Thank you for inviting me.
Sure. A pleasure to have you on. And again, very wonderful to have gotten the book from your publisher. I appreciate that. So much to have gone through. I have greatly enjoyed dissecting the book and just going through it and learning an awful lot and seeing some things that I knew, but maybe finding out different facets of things that I knew. There's all kinds of shadings to when you go through a book like this. So from your perspective as an author taking on this project, what was it like for you?
It was a lot of work. I guess most of the work was just finding the pictures and getting permission to use them, because it's become a lot more difficult than it used to be to use pictures. I got a lot of pictures from the Hall of Fame archives, a whole bunch of Sporting News archives, and a lot from the Library of Congress, which really helped me out.
Well, that's great that there was stuff that was available in that way to be able to help. And there are so many different nuggets that you came across in here and so many different things that are listed just as a brief little aside, but it really gives you something to think about. And along those lines, for anybody going through the book, I found something on page 166, a little aside entitled Computer Manager, where you were talking about Davey Johnson, who certainly in my youth was one of my favorite managers in baseball. I really admired his very progressive style for managing the game, where you're talking about how he's one of the forerunners, essentially, of incorporating computerized data into his managerial strategies, and indeed as a player was even thinking along those lines. And I think back to my childhood even further back, I can't remember the name of it, but there was a hardcover book from the late 70s. It was a novel about, it was basically a comedy novel, sort of a nerdy college kid who, this is with a mainframe computer, I guess, discovers some things that can help his college baseball team and eventually ends up taking them over as manager. And all these things that seemed very futuristic when I'm reading that book, again, kind of a comedy novel, and when Davey Johnson was fiddling around with this as a player and then subsequently as a manager. But that little aside that you have in the book there really sort of prefigures so much of what has happened in today's game, such that I was at an Indians game this past Saturday night, and Jose Ramirez was playing in short right field instead of the standard second base. A ball's hit out there, and a couple of us are screaming, Viva la spray charts. So Davey Johnson, as you chronicled in here, very much ahead of his time.
Yeah, that's true. And even as a player, when he was with the Baltimore Orioles, he used his computer to figure out that the Orioles batting order would be better off if Earl Weaver switched it around and had Davey Johnson batting second. So Davey went to Earl Weaver and told him, and Earl got mad, of course, because Earl always thought he was right and he was into doing with computers, thought it was far-fetched, and look how baseball has changed.
Absolutely, yeah, and that really goes to show you, too, because Earl himself had a lot of clever ideas that other people didn't go with. So just the fact that it was Davey Johnson's idea, I guess, instead of his own, that was something that unfortunately for him prevented him from being able to take advantage of it. But a lot of great breakdowns in the book here as you're going through many of the chapter headings. For example, when you're talking, there's a separate chapter on umpires. There's a separate chapter on equipment, on ballparks, which I found very enjoyable because that's one of the sort of subheadings of baseball that I've been very much interested in over a period of time. Present ballparks, past ones, etc. Famous faces, managers, the brass. I'm not even naming all of the chapter topics here, but just sort of giving people a general sense of this. The media, the language of baseball, superstitions and traditions, spring training. Again, more chapter headings even beyond that. So I'm always fascinated, and we are on this show because it is the show where nothing is off topic, really, by all parts of sort of the creative process, whatever it might be. So similar to if I was having a songwriter on and I was asking them about the process, I'm going to ask you, when you go about trying to put together a project as ambitious as the new baseball Bible, how do you go about doing it? How do you figure out in your head, how many notepads do you go through kind of jotting down and outlining these things as far as the structure of it?
Well, the way I look at this book, remember the Woody Allen movie, Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask? That's
yeah.
Exactly what I did, except to substitute the word baseball for sex. And I also wanted to look at the Old Farmer's Almanac graphically and put a baseball motif on that, and that's what this book looks like. A lot of sidebars, a lot of illustrations, charts, graphs. You can actually put this book in your bathroom, pick it up and read it backwards and still enjoy it.
Exactly. And I have a reading style a lot of times that is sort of an odd one, I think a lot of people would say, where I like to sort of go through a book sometimes almost kind of at random. So this is for people who are in the tiny minority like myself who like to enjoy books that way. For a long, long, long period of time, you can pick up this book, you can flip to random sections of it, and you can find something new.
That's the whole idea. In fact, I wanted to make it so that even the rabbit fan will find something on every page that'll make them say, gee, I didn't know that.
Absolutely, and it is something where, again, it is a sport almost more so than the other major sports in this country that is really kind of so reliant on context. And for your book to be coming out right now, obviously you really couldn't have planned it this way, but in terms of what we've seen, and it's almost 2 years to the date now, people have been pointing to the mid part of the 2015 season when we went into this new sort of home run era, this hyper home run era in Major League Baseball, in ways that are different than the steroid era of the turn of the millennium, though, in terms of overall offense not following in terms of that. Obviously, the shift and other things like that are helping to keep down non-home run forms of offense. But for anybody out there that's, again, kind of, we always go through these periods of puzzlement when we go through these changes, and like, how do you put these things into historical context? You know, your book is very useful for that as you're going through and as you're kind of identifying all these periods in baseball. I always talked about it during the steroid times that the 90s a lot of times were similar to the 30s in a lot of ways in terms of the home runs proliferating. That's the interesting thing about your book in terms of a historical sense, is you can go through and you can find analogs for things in baseball and even periods that you think on the surface are unique.
Very much so. In fact, 1930 would probably be categorized as the year of the hitter. That was the year Hack Wilson hit 56 home runs and drove in 191 runs, which is pretty amazing. That record has never been beaten, that RBI record. And the Phillies, even though they finished dead last and had a team ERA of 6.71, they batted 315 as a team, which is unbelievable. The New York Giants batted 319 as a team. So that was a great offensive year, too. But then you look at a year like 1968, the year of the pitcher, and it went the other way. That was the year Denny McClain won 31 games, and Bob Gibson had a 1.12 ERA. And baseball went wild trying to figure out, how can I get more offense in the game? So they made all kinds of changes, and things reverted. But there have been ups and downs throughout baseball history, more offense, more defense, more pitching, and that's what makes the game great.
Absolutely, and it's funny you mention that about the late 60s, because there are aspects that do kind of change and that are, I guess, a permanent change, because it's hard to imagine baseball going back. And what I mean in that way is the transparency of it, because obviously the pitching mounds were lowered for 1969, and we got out of where we were in 68, where it was peak pitching. Subsequently, with the steroid era, and now with all the theories that are proliferating out there, and I think the best one I've seen has been something about the ability of pitchers to be able to get a grip on the baseball, because it seems to have coincided also with a spike in blisters at this point in time as well. So whatever it's been fairly opaque in the last 2 years. Baseball has not owned up to any of the changes that they've made. So you sort of point out the one thing that has kind of changed, which is the ability to sort of trace through and anticipate what's going to be coming next, because MLB will tell you so.
Yeah, very much so. And obviously, the proliferation of relief pitchers is probably the single greatest change in baseball that I've witnessed in my 50 years covering the game. It used to be that pitchers wanted to go all the way. In fact, Warren Spahn, my favorite pitcher of all time, had 363 wins, the most I've ever seen a pitcher. But he also had 382 complete games. And one of those complete games was a 16-inning complete game he pitched and lost to Juan Marichal when Willie Mays had a home run, 1-0.
Well, see, those are great details there that people will get a chance to really kind of uncover and to be able to further kind of dissect in the course of this book. And for anybody that is a longtime fan of baseball and the history of it, there are certain players that they have that are very much appreciated by them because they feel that they're somewhat under the radar, kind of. I would say for me, in a historical sense, as you go back in time, I don't think he was certainly underrated at the time. He was one of the most prominent players of baseball. But when we look back at the overall history of baseball, and it's funny because years later, I was talking to another friend of mine, and he had exactly the same feeling about the same guy. Jimmy Fox is a guy like that for me, that as prominent as he was at the time, he has sort of gotten lost in the shadow of Ruth Gehrig and some of the other guys of his time period who really kind of tower over him in terms of being a household name. Who are some of the players in the course of baseball history that you have the most appreciated, that you don't feel get the appreciation that they deserve?
Well, number one on the list would have to be Hank Aaron, because people are always talking about Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. And I'm thinking, Hank Aaron stood head and shoulders above Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. So to me, he was the greatest player I've ever seen. But he was a modest guy, introverted guy, never played in New York or L.A., and never got the publicity he deserved until he broke Babe Ruth's record. But I could see it coming, and I actually predicted it 10 years before it happened.
Very interesting, yeah, because he was, again, on a tremendous pace for a long period of time, but he was a guy where, again, I think it just kind of lulled a lot of people to sleep because, with few exceptions, he really didn't tend to have the spectacular spikes in his career that some of the other players did. It was just one of those things where years down the road, you wake up, you look at the all-time totals, and you think to yourself, hey, this guy could have a chance. So credit to you for being one of the people who noticed that ahead of time.
And also, the guy never got hurt. He was hurt his rookie year. He broke his leg sliding. But other than that, he did not get hurt for the rest of his career, and that really helped him. He was very consistent. He was also a three-time Gold Glove winner and a 30-30 guy. People don't remember that.
That's right. He brought a lot on the other side of the ball as well, and that is absolutely the case. And, again, he, like many other great players featured in this great book, The New Baseball Bible, Notes, Nuggets, Lists, and Other Legends from Our National Pastime. Obviously, with this book coming together on the time frame that it did, to tie this somewhat to your last appearance, you did not really have a chance to get into anything with the Braves' new ballpark, which any future histories of baseball, I have to think, are going to cover in some kind of detail, because I can tell you from having been down there to see it, I was really just struck, and I have said to a number of people, the most striking thing for me, I like the park. I don't know if there's any features about it that you would consider to be sort of signature ones in terms of what other parks have. But to me, I think it's going to be a very important thing in the future history of baseball, because the shorthand that I give for people when I tell them about it is they've got their own Wrigleyville down there. I mean, as an economic model, that thing is just very, very striking. This offseason will be very interesting to see how much traffic they develop the other 6 months of the year. That concert hall across the street from the park is not going to hurt matters. But I've tried to describe it to people of everything that they have there, including the residential stuff nearby, high-end. I don't know if it's apartments, condos, or a mix of the two. I'd be shocked if there weren't at least a few players that live there. So that to me is something, that's an aspirational thing, I think, for owners. It's funny, I'm a big Red Wings fan. They're doing the same thing in downtown Detroit, but, you know, good luck trying to make downtown Detroit as much of a destination as the sunny exurbs of Atlanta. So I think what they're doing there, that's got to be the envy of 29 other ownerships in baseball. And something that I think is probably going to greatly influence the history of 21st century baseball going forward. What do you think?
Well, Rick, you'd be right if you were just talking about the ballpark, but the biggest minus is there is no way to get there other than driving. There's no mass transit, and that's the difference between Wrigley Field and SunTrust Park. In fact, if you check out the Braves' attendance over the first few months of the year, you would think that with a brand-new ballpark and a much-improved team, they would draw really well. That has not been the case. Recently, when schools are out, their attendance has spiked a little bit, but it's very difficult to get there. The traffic is a nightmare going and coming.
It's not easy, to be sure. Sitting right there by where 75 hits the outer belt, right there in Cobb County, and you're right about that part of it. And the parking situation is not the greatest either. We kind of dealt with that and trying to find decent and affordable parking somewhere within a minor universe of the ballpark. So it has its downsides as well, to be sure. But as an economic model, again, that's the number one thing that I'm kind of struck by here. And is that something you think that a lot of teams are going to leverage successfully going forward? It's interesting to me because turn of the millennium, really in all four of the major sports, we saw an almost complete turnover in terms of stadiums and arenas, and you wonder how close we are to starting the next one here. Of course, the Braves vacating Turner Field after only 20 years, I think that's an outlier. The Washington Redskins, who got their stadium at about the same time, are actively looking for something else now, but I think they're the outliers. I think it's going to take a little bit longer here because it seems like just yesterday, whether it was or not, that we built a lot of these new, we being the taxpayers in most cases, new stadiums and arenas in most places. But do you think this Braves Park is going to be very influential as far as what owners are able to do for their next round of shakedowns?
I do, but there have been several parks over the last few years that have tried to copy that formula. Target Field in Minneapolis is one of those. You can actually see the buildings of downtown. You can walk there from downtown, which is great. And, you know, obviously if you're a Twins fan, if you're from out of town, and a lot of Twins fans are, they can stay in a hotel and walk to the ballpark, and everything is right there, right around the ballpark, which I think is wonderful. I was there for the All-Star game in 2014 and really, really enjoyed it. And there's some other ballparks, too. San Diego, Petco Park. By the way, I've been to all 30 parks. So,
okay.
The All-Star game in Miami was number 30 for me. Marlins Park, that was the last one I had not seen. So I've been to all 30. But I love Petco Park in San Diego because you can also walk there from the hotels or from downtown. So that's a big plus. The Atlanta one is a problem because of the mass transit. They really need to do something about that or they're going to have a problem. They are hoping to generate enough revenue to be active in the free agent market. So far, they're not doing that.
Very interesting. Yeah, could be some adjustments to be made going forward for them. And again, when you're talking about classic ballparks, they don't get much more classic, albeit on a small level feel than what's in Cooperstown, New York. We are just about coming up to Hall of Fame weekend, which I know is always a point of interest for you. So with this book being fresh in your mind, the timing of it, of just having wrapped it up, of doing interviews such as this one, what are some of your foremost thoughts going to Cooperstown this weekend with this book just in your rearview mirror?
Well, I am going to be doing three signings in Cooperstown this weekend, so I'm looking forward to that. One of the signings will be Saturday at Main Street, which is going to be closed except for pedestrian traffic. No vehicles on Main Street. I'll be signing between 11 and 1 in front of the Rare Bookstore, so that should be a lot of fun. But basically, the Hall of Fame. I love Cooperstown, but I would like to see the Hall of Fame voting change. There's a lot about the Hall of Fame in my book as well. 75% doesn't cut it if they're going to let people vote and put no names on the ballot or one name on the ballot. The writers have to fill out those ballots, all 10 spots, your order of preference, because otherwise it skews the vote and makes it really hard. And that's why Trevor Hausman has now missed 2 years in a row. Vladimir Guerrero didn't get in last year. And that's why Jeff Bagwell had to wait for 7 years. So you've got to do something about the vote.
Well, yeah, there needs to be better accountability, and unfortunately, we live in a day and age also, too, especially with social media, where somebody can become a minor celebrity briefly for choices that they make. I always hate in any medium that we're talking about here, sports, non-sports, whatever, when it's somebody in the media using an event to try to get themselves over. And there have been a lot of attention-getting stunts with the ballots over the years, not least of which I think Bill Conlon famously had the one of, "I will never vote for any player on the first ballot ever." So anything that seems to be done to use something to call attention to yourself, I think that's one of the categories that you're probably talking about there as far as writers and their accountability and how they should just be honoring a straight process and really regarding the opportunity to cast the ballot as an honor.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you can always argue specific players like Jack Morris, I think, ought to be in the Hall of Fame. Dale Murphy probably should be in the Hall of Fame. And there's some guys in the Hall of Fame who probably shouldn't be. Bill Mazeroski being number one on that list, if not for that home run, there's no way he'd be in Cooperstown.
That's right about that. And, you know, it's interesting, too, with the Hall of Fame weekend here, it reminds me of another thing from your book, a mental note that I made that I'm glad I thought of just now, and that being, again, I'm old enough, as are a few people out there, to remember the day when they would have the two teams. This was when there was no interleague play in the regular season. You would have a game that would be played there. It would be an exhibition game. Again, very much along the lines of what the NFL still does, except that it would be in the middle of the season here. And that reminds me of your little blurb in there about that Rangers-Giants game in 97 that was the first interleague game ever. And one of my great frustrations with MLB over a period of time, I feel like, is that they never miss a chance to miss a chance, particularly, again, you know, with the Angels and the Dodgers. That's a thing where, not that it should be the opening night game every year, but, I mean, the chance to have Kershaw and Trout against one another, I think you should probably try to do everything you can to maximize the chances of that game being on national TV. It certainly would be if it were in any other sport. And the first game ever in interleague play in 97, I remember thinking that I was horrified. It was I was watching baseball tonight, and they were like, "Here, let's show you some stuff from this game earlier tonight." And I'm thinking to myself, you know, for any real baseball fans out there, you almost could have put the game on pay-per-view. I mean, the way that they trotted it out, I think, has been a big part of really kind of demystifying the whole thing now, to where people just take it for granted. Kids today, I'm dating myself here, I'm like, "Oh, what, you mean it used to be just in the American League, just in the National League?" So I think, unfortunately, the way that they've handled that from the very beginning has really kind of trampled on the specialness of it. And I'm not even necessarily an advocate of interleague play, but interleague play ought to at least mean something, and it doesn't mean anything to anybody anymore if it ever did.
I agree totally. I never liked interleague play. I think it really detracts from spring training. It detracts from the World Series. You know, when the Yankees and Mets play, or the White Sox and Cubs, those are great games, and Dodgers and Angels, as you mentioned. However, Giants, Rangers, I mean, you play for every good interleague game, you have 10 that are lousy. And it also detracts from schedule, because National League teams should play each other more often, and American League teams should play each other more often. And then you have a pure pennant race.
Exactly. And we're down to a situation now where in my hometown of Cleveland, we only get the Red Sox coming through once a year, the Yankees once a year. Those are the teams that we like to gear up for a long period of time to be able to hate them and then have them come back and hate them again. And we only get one crack when they come through town now. So that's been one of the consequences of interleague play. And again, that is just a small part of what people can trace through the totality here of the new baseball Bible: notes, nuggets, lists, and legends from our national pastime. A great book, Dan. Of course, the foreword by Jay Johnstone and preface by Alan Schwartz. And a wonderful, wonderful book, which I am very appreciative to have. And again, anything that we didn't hit about that book that you feel like should be out there, please take it away.
Well, there's a lot about women in baseball, which I really enjoy. There was a 17-year-old woman named Jackie Mitchell. In 1932, she struck out Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig in an exhibition game. She was pitching for the Chattanooga Lookouts. And the very next day, Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis voided her contract and said baseball was too rough for girls. Well, obviously, it wasn't.
Well, exactly. And again, I'm I don't think I would meet anybody's definition of being a feminist, but it's a thing where if you're talking about on a level playing field, if she would have been capable of doing that, then, you know, let the strong survive, basically. So that's kind of it. But that's pretty much exactly what you would have expected from a figure like Commissioner Landis, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and he also kept blacks and minorities out of Major League Baseball. And, you know, once he was gone from the scene, Happy Chandler went along with Brant Rickey, and that's why we have integrated baseball today.
Exactly. Yeah, things picked up from there. And, again, this entire rich history of baseball, a history I believe richer than that of any of the other major sports, at least in this country, people can really enjoy it. The New Baseball Bible, notes, nuggets, lists, and legends from our national pastime. A pleasure to have you on again this time, Dan Schlossberg. Thank you so much for being on. Look forward to doing it again. Best of luck in the promotion and success of this book.
Thank you very much, Rick. I really appreciate it.
Great to have you on, Dan. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today for FDH Lounge mini episode number 866.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Aquafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.